with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we have our weekly live report from the Portland City Council. The National Security Agency destroyed the names of thousands of Americans and U.S. companies it collected on its own volition following 9/11. And Ehud Olmert has taken over Israel's leadership following Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's massive stroke.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,187 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,263 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 5th, 2006. I'm Eduardo Delanderos Tierre.
And I'm Noah Eaton.
Detectives investigating the officer-involved shooting on Alameda Street early yesterday morning interviewed the shooter, Southeast Precinct Lieutenant Jeffrey M. Kayer, 43, this morning. Detectives yesterday also interviewed East Precinct Officer Lawrence Keller, 45, the lieutenant Kayer's backup on the scene. The case now will be presented to a Multnomah County grand jury for review. Officials said there was no identification on the victim's body. The shooting comes less than a year after Portland Chief Derek Foxworth adopted a new policy regarding shooting at a moving vehicle, in which the chief stated that officers threatened by an oncoming car should try to get out of its path instead of firing at it or its occupants. Police said the investigation was not complete and that whether the shooting fell within Bureau policy would be the subject of an internal review. The police lieutenant, who decided to check out a suspicious car parked in front of his sister's home early Wednesday, ended up fatally shooting the man behind the wheel. Police said Kayer fired two shots at the driver after the man smashed the stolen car into a tree across the street in an attempt to get away, then placed the car in reverse, heading toward Kayer and another police officer.
The Portland City Council yesterday moved to investigate PGE. KBOO reporter Andy Seaton has the story.
The Portland City Council started the new year dealing with the past, present, and future. The council dealt with the past by dealing with Portland General Electric. They reauthorized the city attorney to investigate PGE on several fronts. Portland City Attorney Linda Meng lists them.
To investigate the activities upon which the calculation and collection of the Multnomah County income tax was based. This resolution asks that we investigate that as well. It also includes that we look at the basis as well as the amount for the taxes that were collected. And then the last change is in the last direction in item 5 that directs us to look for any additional information that would be of assistance in determining the reasonableness of PGE rates.
Commissioner Dan Salzman questioned some of the language, and Randy Leonard explained.
Okay, so the reasonableness applies to reasonableness of business practices. Right. It's not reasonableness of rates as may be determined by any kind of a state PUC rate-making standard. I just want to make sure.
Only to the extent, I mean, I don't think that the standard we're talking about you will have a dispute with. In other words, if we find that trades occurred, and this is just a hypothetical, that were improper trades that involved circular trading for the sole purpose of increasing the cost of energy in a contract for the purpose of increasing revenue, that would be an improper business practice reflected in the rates. That's what this is intended to get at, not some other subjective comparison of PGE rates to somebody else. That's not an appropriate comparison. What we're looking at are actual hard costs and documentation to reflect those hard costs, and if there are costs built into the rates that are based on inappropriate activities, we want to have the authority to ask for that information.
The ordinance passed unanimously. The council then took up an emergency request from Tryon Life Community Farm to assist with the purchase of its land. Commissioner Sam Adams explains why the city agreed to help.
What's in the city's interest? This is a 7-acre farm. It is surrounded on three sides by Tryon Creek State Park. The city has a vested interest in protecting the health and functions of its watersheds, including Tryon Creek. The city's contribution, in concert with contributions from Metro, Oregon State Parks, purchases a 1-acre conservation easement that forever protects valuable forests and resources and land from development. The funding for this comes from existing revenues that is intended to provide exactly what this project does, and that is watershed restoration. So it comes out of not the general fund, but from watershed management funds in the Bureau of Environmental Services.
The project was almost derailed by Commissioner Eric Sten because of a recent right-wing support. Brenna Bell, president of the Tryon Farm Board, broke the sad news.
Today, the Oregonian editorial board came out in support of us. So you'll be in good company supporting TLT Farm. The Oregonian actually won't get on your
editorial we've had.
You know, I have to note, we were also on the Lars Larson show yesterday, and even he said at the end that he thinks it might be a good idea for people to contribute. So.
Oh, you just lost me votes.
Sorry.
It was tough.
It was tough.
I never voted for anything that Lars and the editorial board.
Luckily, we have.
La, disclosure.
We have a project that's so across the board appealing that we can get even your worst critics to say that it might be a good idea.
However, these partisan differences were set aside and the item passed unanimously. Looking to the future, the council also took testimony on raising public art funding. They want to raise the current 1.33% to 1.2%. The proposal will also set aside 10% of the new funds for maintenance of existing art projects. The rules and procedures governing public art will also be clarified and strengthened. The final vote will be taken next week. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
A unique experiment in urban agriculture is racing against the clock to save their farm. The Tryon Life Community Farm has until January 10th to raise the final $150,000 of the $1.5 million needed to purchase the land and save it from development. Live on the phone to talk about that is Brenna Bell. Brenna, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, it's my pleasure.
Well, first, describe the farm and tell us what do you do and what makes it special.
Sure. Tryon Life Community Farm is a 7-acre parcel that's actually surrounded on three sides by Tryon Creek State Park in southwest Portland. It's a chance to have a very different kind of urban experience, very different environment. You can feel like you're on a rural farm surrounded by forest, which you are, but still in the city limits and on a bus line. What we do here is a number of things. We are a public resource where we're open to the public at least 2 days a week, currently every day, for people to come in, see demonstrations of sustainability and sustainable living. We teach classes to students from four-year-olds from Head Start to college classes who've come here and do really hands-on work, including cob and straw bale construction, organic gardening, and permaculture design. We're also really active in doing watershed restoration in the area of the land that bounds the park to try and remove invasive species, replant with natives, and be a demonstration where other people can come and learn similar techniques.
We've heard you and others on several KBOO shows over the past several weeks talking about this fundraising project. So can you give us an update of where you are in your fundraising drive and what people can do to help?
Sure. Well, right now things are really good. I just returned from the Metro Regional Government voting unanimously to contribute $100,000 towards a conservation easement on the land, which is great. It's money that we were expecting, but to have them commit it unanimously felt really, really good. And so with that and with the outpouring of public support that we found this week, we're just about $60,000 shy now of our needed goal. And when you're looking at a contract price of over $1.5 million, $60,000 feels really, really doable. And it can, you know, what people can do right now is one of two things. One is donate, of course. Every bit helps. If it's $25, if it's $25,000, we'll gladly accept it and apply it towards maintaining this as a public resource. And the other thing we really need right now is volunteers. We have so much going on that daily there are a lot of tasks and fun ways to get involved at the farm.
Thanks,
we also
Brenna.
Want people to come out and visit.
Thanks, Brenna. And that was Brenna Bell, of course, from the TLC Farm in Portland.
Oregon Representative Peter DeFazio will return $1,500 he received from out-of-state Indian tribes represented by disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff, his office announced today. DeFazio, a Democrat, received $500 from the Agua Caliente Band of Coahuila Indians in California in 2000, and $1,000 from the Saguna Chippewa Indian Tribe in Michigan last year. Christy Greco, a spokesman for DeFazio, said that while the contributions were legal, DeFazio thought it was appropriate to return the money, given Abramoff's guilty plea in a burgeoning corruption scandal. DeFazio's announcement comes one day after a spokesman for Oregon Senator Gordon Smith said the Republican lawmakers returning or giving away $8,500 in campaign contributions related to Abramoff.
Many Republicans have been caught up in the web of Jack Abramoff's illicit dealings, but at least one Democrat is unrepentant in receiving money from sources linked to Abramoff. Lisa Loving has the story.
Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, will not be returning more than $40,000 in contributions from out-of-state Indian tribes represented by disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Murray's total places her ninth among lawmakers and second among Democrats who received campaign donations from tribes associated with Abramoff, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, a Washington, D.C.-based group that tracks money in politics. Abramoff pleaded guilty Tuesday to fraud, corruption, and tax evasion in a wide-ranging political corruption investigation. In Miami yesterday, he pleaded guilty to conspiracy and wire fraud charges stemming from his purchase of a gambling boat fleet 6 years ago. The contributions received by Murray were legal under federal election law, and a spokeswoman for the senator said she had no intention of returning the money or donating it to charity, as some lawmakers have done. Murray does not know Abramoff and has never met with him, spokeswoman Alex Glass said. Quote, this money is not coming from Jack Abramoff. It's not related to him, unquote, Glass said Wednesday. Murray, quote, received contributions from tribes, unquote, Glass said. Quote, what we've seen throughout her career is she is a strong advocate for tribal sovereignty and tribal issues, and that's why tribes give to her, unquote. A spokesman for Oregon Senator Gordon Smith, meanwhile, said the Republican lawmaker is returning or giving away $8,500 in campaign contributions related to Abramoff. Smith returned $3,500 in contributions to two tribes before Abramoff's guilty plea and donated $4,000 to charity, including $2,000 received from Abramoff in 2001 and 2002, spokesman Chris Matthews said. A leadership committee that received $1,000 from a lobbying firm where Abramoff worked also donated the money to charity. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
A study of the aftermath of the 2002 Biscuit Fire concludes that logging burned trees killed large numbers of seedlings that sprouted on their own and increased the short-term damage of wildfire. The study has become the focus of debate over national forest management. It will be published tomorrow in the journal Science Express and later in Science. It comes as conservationists and the timber industry battle over a bill in Congress. The measure speeds up the process of evaluating whether to harvest burned trees and plant new seedlings on the millions of acres of national forests that burn every year. Ignited by a series of lightning strikes, the Biscuit Fire burned 500,000 acres of the Siskiyou National Forest in southwestern Oregon. It was the biggest fire in the country in 2002.
Hundreds of young progressive activists are expected at a political conference on Mount Hood. Joshua Johnson has more on the story.
About 300 progressive activists, many in their 20s and early 30s, will converge on Mount Hood this weekend for a political conference aimed at mobilizing and inspiring a new generation to get involved. Called Rebooting Democracy, the conference is sponsored by the Bus Project. The Bus Project has recruited thousands of young activists for door-to-door canvassing, voter registration drives, and political pressure campaigns conducted via email. Organizers will encourage attendees to debate and rank 10 initiative measures contending for Oregon's November ballot, and then commit money or volunteer labor to the campaigns. Many young people have grown up in the Sizemore era of tax cutting, anti-union, and other conservative measures sponsored by Bill Sizemore and the Oregon Taxpayers United. The goal is to restore grassroots energy and progressive values to Oregon initiative campaigns. Featured speakers this year include former Texas Agriculture Commissioner and current radio commentator Jim Hightower, and Andre Cherney, speechwriter for then-Vice President Al Gore and author of a new book called The Next Deal. Homegrown speakers include two potential 2006 candidates for governor, ex-governor John Kitzhaber and Republican Senator Ben Westland, who is sowing the seeds for running as an independent. For KBOO News, I'm Joshua Johnson.
A British court ruling today affects Oregon and the suspected al-Qaeda member. The London court ruled that the suspected al-Qaeda member can be extradited to the United States to stand trial for allegedly plotting to set a terrorist training camp in Oregon. The ruling came after the U.S. government reassured the court that the British defendant, Harun Ashid Azwat, would be tried at a U.S. federal court, not a military tribunal. Azwat's lawyer immediately appealed. Azwat was arrested in Zambia in connection with the July 7th bombings in London that killed 52 transit passengers. Azwat has denied any involvement in terrorism. Federal prosecutors in New York have charged several men in the alleged conspiracy to set up the terrorist training camp in Oregon with members of a now-defunct Seattle mosque.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that Jose Padilla, accused of terrorism, can be transferred to a civilian custody, but that ruling would not mean his legal challenge to the president's indefinite detention powers will be thrown out either. From WMMF in Tampa, Andrew Stelter reports.
Padilla, an American citizen, was held for over 3 years without charge on suspicion of planning to explode a radioactive dirty bomb, but was recently indicted on unrelated charges. The Bush administration had been advancing an argument that if Padilla is transferred from military custody, his pending Supreme Court challenge to Bush's powers to detain American citizens without charge should be thrown out. While the Supreme Court justices overruled last month's appeals court denial of the transfer to civilian custody, they said they will consider whether to hear the challenge to Bush's indefinite detentions at a later time. That case is set for review at a private meeting of the justices on January 13th. Padilla now will be brought from a military brig in South Carolina to law enforcement authorities in Miami, where he will face charges that he conspired with al-Qaeda to commit terrorist attacks overseas. For FSRN, from WMNF in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The current time is 5:17. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News. Cereal manufacturer Kellogg will begin using genetically modified soybean oil in some products beginning this year. More than 7,000 Iraqis, most of them civilians, were killed in violence in 2005, according to an Iraq death count service. And at last, clear-cut evidence of daytime soap opera absurdity. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
U.S. Representative Edward Markey held an emergency town meeting last night to discuss the Bush authorization of domestic spying. This was the first public meeting of its kind to discuss the ramifications of this practice on our constitutional rights. Chuck Rosina files this report from Boston.
The location of this meeting is on Paul Revere's route, and Representative Markey made several references to a modern-day sounding of the alarm that our freedom is under attack. Using recent quotes from President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Attorney General Gonzalez, including right up to January 4th, the same day this meeting took place, Representative Markey analyzed and discussed how these actions eroded our civil liberties. President Bush has authorized spying on American citizens as part of his war on terror without obtaining court approval at any time. Representative Markey was joined by panelists Carol Rose, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union, and Mark Rotsberg, Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Representative Markey framed the debate in terms of our right to privacy.
It is, without question, a serious threat to the privacy of all Americans if the government believes that it has an inherent authority, regardless of any laws on the books, to be able to go to telephone companies, internet companies, cell phone companies, and just find out everything that you're doing. And we're not talking about foreigners here. This whole debate is about American citizens.
Representative Markey and his staff had organized the evening into what they called eight myths that President Bush operates under. For example, myth number 5 stated that the National Security Agency program was not hidden from congressional oversight. President Bush claims that members of Congress are periodically briefed. Markey pointed out that he is the senior Democrat on the Homeland Security Committee east of the Mississippi, yet he has never been briefed. Carol Rose of the Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union responded to this myth.
I think we need a special prosecutor with subpoena powers who's going to be able to look and see in this area and in others what the president's doing. And the only other point I would make, which is it's a fundamental attack on the system of checks and balances, and that's what we need to do, is to restore our system of checks and balances. The government is increasing its power to watch you and diminishing your power to watch the government, and that is extraordinarily dangerous.
Myth number 7 stated that the FISA court places undue restrictions in fighting the war on terror. Mark Rottenberg of the Electronic Privacy Information Center responded.
What they're basically saying is they're upset that they can't do data mining, warrantless data mining.
Right.
That's what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, isn't that it? They're saying we have this tremendous surveillance capability. It's called the National Security Agency. We want to get everything we possibly can and sort it out later. And they're frustrated they can't do that because of something, I guess, called the Fourth Amendment. Well, you know, welcome to America. We have a constitution.
Representative Markey noted that this whole thing unfolded less than 3 weeks ago, and with the holidays in between, he was impressed with both the work that his staff had done and the turnout to this town meeting. The auditorium at the museum at our National Heritage was filled to capacity. During the question period, Representative Markey was asked about the president's pledge to uphold the Constitution. He responded,
I think that there is a strong libertarian strain which runs through the Republican Party that is going to join up with the very strong civil liberties strain that runs through the Democratic Party. So I think that the president is going to be on the run from the day that we get back to Washington. And I think that
there were also questions on how to move forward, including blocking the nomination of Judge Sam Alito and filing articles of impeachment. Through a show of hands, it was clear that President Bush had no supporters for his domestic surveillance in this crowd. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina, reporting from Lexington, Massachusetts.
The Bush administration handed out the first hurricane relief payments to schools and colleges, awarding more than $250 million to four Gulf Coast states as part of $1.6 billion in recovery aid. The lump sum payments include help for private schools that some critics have assailed as a national voucher experiment. The money went out 1 week after President Bush signed the legislation into law. The awards include $100 million each for Louisiana and Mississippi, $50 million for Texas, and $3.75 million for Alabama. Additional funds will go out as states provide data on exactly how much is needed and what for what purpose. States are being asked to set aside money for private schools based roughly on the percentage of public and private schools in the state. Private schools could apply for the aid. An estimated 372,000 students have been forced into different schools because of the hurricanes, which struck in August and September.
A panel of judges appointed by the World Trade Organization has once again delayed a preliminary decision on genetically modified crops. FSRN's Naomi Fowler has more from London.
Many European Union countries have been refusing to accept genetically modified crop imports for years. The issue has been the subject of an intense battle of wills between the European Union and GMO-producing United States, Canada and Argentina. Millions of dollars in trade are at stake. The United States has long labelled European Union objections to and restrictions on genetically modified food imports as protectionism. They claim the restrictions violate World Trade Organization rules. But EU objections are based on evidence they say shows Europeans don't want GM food. GM food is labelled in some EU countries, unlike in the US, and surveys seem to show that European consumers reject GM foods at levels of around 70%. Deadlines on a final ruling have been extended ever since the World Trade Organization panel of judges was set up in 2004. The final ruling will now be in March. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Randall McCloy, the only survivor of Monday's explosion at the Sago coal mine in West Virginia, is in critical condition after 42 hours trapped in the mine. Meanwhile, the Charleston Gazette is reporting the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration filed 200 safety violations against the mine in the past year. Families of the 12 victims are discussing lawsuits against the company, and elected officials are demanding answers about whether the blast could have been prevented. From Washington, D.C., FSRN's Ingrid Drake reports.
The White House and Republican Congress members have denied Democrats' call for immediate congressional hearings into the Sago tragedy, asking instead to wait for the U.S. Department of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration to conduct its investigation. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan.
In terms of the federal government, the Secretary of Labor earlier today announced that they will fully investigate this tragic, this tragedy that occurred in West Virginia, and they will take steps to prevent something like this from happening again when they complete that investigation and learn more about what caused this to happen.
How public these investigations will be is not clear, says Alan Smith, editor of Mind Safety and Health News.
MSHA has an excellent forensic team that can go in and reconstruct an accident scene. What I don't have faith in is the fact that it's so difficult anymore to get records from MSHA, and I mean factual records that are not opinion. When there were accidents in the past, we could get minor witness interviews, we could get citations issued to the mine, we could get dust sample violations, things like that. MSHA is no longer making that material available to the press or the public.
Several times during the last 6 months, sections of the roof at the Sago mine have collapsed. It is unclear how this and 101 other safety violations classified as significant and substantial were addressed by the mine's owner. Smith says that while the industry has made great improvements in safety, there is much more to do.
If you follow the regulations and you follow your mining plans, including your ventilation and roof control plans, you just don't have these accidents.
The Sago mine, which operates 24 hours a day, is owned by the International Coal Group. The Kentucky-based company operates 11 mining complexes in Illinois, Maryland, Kentucky, and West Virginia, and boasts on its website that its mines are, quote, union-free. While the International Coal Group contributed $2 million to the Sago Mine Fund to provide financial support to the families, some of the families say they are considering legal action. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
In Iraq's deadliest day in months, bombs killed at least 120 Iraqis and 7 U.S. soldiers today, shattering hopes that last month's election and the new year would usher in a more peaceful era. At least 200 people were wounded in the attacks on Iraqis in two cities. Another 3 bombs exploded in Baghdad, 2 of them detonated by suicide bombers, while anti-U.S. fighters reportedly sabotaged an oil pipeline near the northern city of Kirkuk, causing a huge fire there. The attacks in one of the Shiite Islam's holiest cities, Karbala, and the Sunni Arab stronghold of Ramadi raised fears of an escalation in sectarian tensions. Meanwhile, the U.S. military said a roadside bomb killed 5 American soldiers patrolling the Baghdad area. Earlier, Iraqi police captain Rahim Slahu said a U.S. convoy was heading for Karbala when it was attacked 15 miles south of the city and that 5 soldiers there were killed. It was the worst single attack in Iraq since July and the latest in a long string of assaults on police and army recruits, tasked with taking over the lead in the fight against the largely Sunni Arab rebellion from the U.S. military.
Today, women across the planet began launching a campaign to pull U.S. troops out of Iraq. The Women Say No to War campaign aims to gather 100,000 signatures of support by International Women's Day on March 8th and deliver the signatures to politicians in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. FSRN's Leilani Albano reports.
Female legislators, activists, authors, and actors are among those taking part in an international effort to end the Iraq War. Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee, mother of deceased soldier Cindy Sheehan, authors Maxine Hong Kingston and Alice Walker, and actress Margaret Cho are among those expected to participate. Initiated by the social justice group Code Pink, the goal of the campaign is to gather 100,000 signatures from women from all parts of the world to demand an end to the U.S. invasion in the region. Jody Evans is a co-founder of Code Pink.
We've been collecting endorsers, women from around the world who eagerly have joined us. Enough. We've had enough. We need to get out of Iraq.
Organizers say the situation in Iraq has grown dire. According to Code Pink statistics, 100,000 Iraqis, 2,182 U.S. troops, 98 U.K. soldiers, and hundreds of humanitarian aid workers have died as a result of the occupation. Of all of the victims, women have been especially devastated by the violence.
Women have been really the first victims of this war and ongoing occupation of Iraq.
Hussan Mahmoud is a campaign participant and spokeswoman for the group Equality for Women in Iraq.
It's a really, really difficult situation is being created, particularly for women in Iraq due to the occupation. They were the first victims to lose almost all their basic rights, and that they found themselves being attacked, kidnapped, raped, sold to the neighboring countries for prostitution, and actually they cannot even go out.
Jody Evans says that women in the U.S. are also being victimized by the war effort.
We're suffering not only the mothers like Cindy Sheehan who've lost their children. There are the thousands of mothers whose children have come back maimed and wounded. And then we have those of us who suffer because of our education needs being cut, our health needs being cut.
Instead of war, the campaign promotes a conflict resolution model, calling for the full withdrawal of troops, full representation of women in the peace process, and gender equality following the withdrawal.
We call on all the people across the world to actually support progressive, secular, left forces inside Iraq, the women's organizations, unions, and other left organizations in Iraqi society, because they're the only hope, really, in Iraq.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
Ehud Olmert, a blunt cigar-smoking political planner, was Ariel Sharon's staunchest ally during the Prime Minister's transformation from a hawk to a moderate viewpoint. With Sharon's sudden collapse, the grim-faced Olmert took the reins of power today, trying to convey the continuity there, but acknowledging in his special cabinet session that the nation, like his mentor, is in a serious situation. If Sharon remains incapacitated after his massive stroke, Olmert could be one of the top contenders for prime minister in a March 28th election. Still, the 60-year-old Olmert will probably never be as popular as his mentors, many say, placing the future of the new centrist Kadima party established by Sharon in political limbo. Olmert was Sharon's strongest supporter as the prime minister withdrew Israeli settlers and soldiers from the Gaza Strip in September. When other members of the hardline Likud party turned on Sharon because of the Gaza pullout, Olmert stood by the prime minister. Olmert was first elected to parliament at age 28, serving as a lawmaker for seven terms and holding several ministerial posts. In those years, Olmert was investigated repeatedly for corruption, but was never convicted of wrongdoing.
And now, 1 minute dedicated to the lighter side of the news. A team of U.S. medical researchers has confirmed what the world has long suspected. Television really is the idiot box. After studying 9 television soap operas broadcasted over more than 10 years, the researchers concluded that the stories portrayed were absurd. They examined the cases of 64 characters in shows such as General Hospital, Days of Our Lives, The Young and the Restless, and The Bold and the Beautiful, who played patients in comas. In contrast to real-life cases, television coma patients almost always make a full recovery. In 89% of the television cases, the patients made full recoveries. Only 8% died, and just 3% remained, quote, in a vegetative state. Such spectacular recovery rates contrasted sharply with reality, in which survival cases were typically, quote, 50% or less. Furthermore, on TV, all surviving patients eventually regained full function, which is very unusual. The TV recovery statistics were even more dramatic because, quote, two patients who died were later revealed to be alive. The researchers expressed concern that the dramas, watched by more than 40 million Americans and broadcast in at least 90 countries, could encourage unrealistic expectations about the prospect of recovery for relatives and friends in real comas.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Proverbial Perspectives. His topic is the case for intelligent design. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob, of course. Tonight's weather, it's going to be raining, breezy, lows around 45. And then tomorrow, the same thing, lots of rain, highs around 50. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The current time is 5:34, and now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Robert Miller is a corporate turnaround specialist, but his specialty really amounts to nothing more than whacking blue-collar workers.
Miller was brought in as CEO of Delphi Corporation last July in the wake of an accounting scandal by various top executives, a scandal that helped bring the corporation to the brink of bankruptcy. After only 3 months at the helm of Delphi, the nation's largest maker of auto components, Miller announced his corporate makeover plan. Declare bankruptcy, slash the wages of blue-collar workers by two-thirds, end health care for retirees, and move more of Delphi's work offshore. Everyone must sacrifice, he sternly told workers. Everyone? Not those at the top. To the contrary, the day before announcing his plan, Miller quietly set up a $110 million bonus package for the 21 top executives working under him, even though 14 of them had been complicitous in the accounting fraud. When exposed, this gob of greed caused such an uproar that Miller had to rush out and announce that, well, gosh, he and the other execs now wanted to share the workers' pain. Delphi's number two honcho would take a 20% cut in salary, he said, and the 20 other top dogs would take a 10% cut. Also, by gollies, Miller said he was cutting his own pay to $1 a year. This reborn working-class hero then appealed to the workers' sympathy with this sob story. I can be fired tomorrow with no severance, no pension, no bonus, not even a ticket home. Before we all join Bob in a chorus of solidarity forever, let's note that those 21 highly paid executives are still in line for those bonuses. And, oh, Bob forgot to mention that he is sitting on a $3 million signing bonus he got when he joined Delphi 6 months ago. This is Jim Hightower saying, as one worker put it after seeing the whole Delphi mess and Miller's flimflam, you feel like throwing up. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
And now on tonight's news, we'd like to open up the phone lines for your thoughts on how we should improve our broadcasts. So the number for calling in is 503-281-8187, 503-281-8187. First, we're going to take a musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be asking for your call, so stay tuned. This is the KBOO Evening News. 5032318187. NOAA. 5032318187.
We are very interested in hearing what you all like to think out there. After all, this is a community newscast, and we'd be very blessed to hear what you want to see the direction of our newscast go. And so it looks like we have two callers available. So let's get them on.
Hello?
Hello.
I'd like to make a couple of recommendations. Democracy Now! Airs four times a day on Free Speech TV, and I think we could definitely air it at least twice a day. For some of the people that are working at 11 to 12 a.m. And also you might consider pre-recording the newscast so you can get away from all the miscues and double talk and, you know, just the, all the technical errors that happen when you do a live thing. If you just, like, pre-record it, you can edit it and fix all the glitches and then put out a nice seamless newscast. And keep up the good work. And thank you. Take care.
We are thinking about pre-recording a part of our newscast. So
we are currently considering eventually getting toward having like a great professional like webmaster, and I wish we could pre-record the entire hour of the newscast and then provide it to the web via we use something called FileZilla, in which we used to get some of our particular news reports onto the website. And so we're currently trying to figure that out, and we very much appreciate your concerns.
Hey, one thing that I think sets KBOO's news apart from most other news, because a lot of people watch or listen to news and then they just feel kind of disempowered and kind of hopeless. But on a KBOO news story, we feel a bit more involved, especially when it's followed up with a phone number. For instance, tonight, this report about TLC Farm ended without their phone number or address when they were looking for volunteers. And it left a couple of us kind of like, oh, well, you know, we want to get over there and help them volunteer. But for the most part, KBOO's news is really good in that sense, and that we feel a little bit more powerful with a story that, that ends with something that people can do instead of just listen.
Exactly. I mean, I've been listening to the Hightower commentary, for instance, and often I notice how he himself would always provide like some a phone number information to like where you could call and get involved with some program. And you definitely make a really good point. We've recently, within the last 2 months in particular, we've been moving toward getting live interviews and live reports into our newscast again, kind of re-embracing that kind of a communal aspect in which I felt we were a little dry on beforehand, and we're moving toward that direction. So very much appreciate you for calling.
And another thing I wanted to point out is that we're not trying so much, I think, to make our newscast professional. Other people are already trying to be professional. What we are trying to do is present a viewpoint that's not being presented otherwise. And that's what's making me very excited is our community radio station presenting what is not being talked about. And I love it. And we have another caller. That's great.
Yay.
Hello?
Hey.
Hi. I guess I must be on the air.
Yes, you are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. I just want to start by saying I love KBOO, and I really appreciate the news you're putting on. I really appreciate it. It's wonderful. It is an alternative viewpoint. It is information I don't hear other places. And thank you all for doing that.
Oh, you're most welcome.
There was one little thing that I did want to mention, which is I would like to ask the news volunteers to, if they would consider being really careful about semantics. For instance, I did hear an evening news KBOO report about the folks that have been arrested, that are members of Earth First and PETA, and I'm not sure, a couple organizations have been referred to in the mass media as eco-terrorists.
Yes, exactly.
And the KBOO news report that I heard also called them eco-terrorists. And maybe there were some other reports where that was caught and that wasn't happening, but I would like to suggest that perhaps on every news story, before it goes out, whoever prepares it just sort of looks through it, or that everybody keep in mind as they write the stories, keep in mind sort of like skimming the stories and checking for words that are actually, that we're so used to hearing now that we may overlook, but that are actually part of the neocon spin. Eco-terrorists, take out instead of kill, collateral damage instead of, I don't know, I guess what does that refer to, civilians that have been killed. So I would like to ask if you folks could maybe make a real point of noticing and changing those, because words can be very powerful.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're
good. Let me briefly say that's critical right now, and it's really I try to do my best to get away from euphemisms and things like calling human beings illegal aliens.
Me too.
We got a caller. Go ahead, caller, are you there?
Hi, would that be me?
Yes, that would be you.
Excellent. I would actually like to strongly reiterate the previous caller's point. I think there's a lot of language, kind of euphemistic language, and shorthand that does get into the newscasts that, you know, if anyone, KBOO should really kind of ferret that stuff out. But that wasn't exactly why I was calling. I was calling to encourage people to, and particularly anchors, but I suppose also folks who are writing the news, to do what is possible to get pronunciations of words correct, and maybe standardize some pronunciations. I heard in this evening's newscast, one of you guys would say Iraq, and the other one was saying Iraq. And just little stuff like that.
Yeah.
Can sound really awkward, especially if it's, you know, two stories about Iraq right after each other.
And we absolutely understand your concern. I do my best in terms of when looking at world leaders' names for particular, I usually go to the web and use what's called the VOA pronunciation guide, and I do my best to try to go through all the stories with a fine-tooth comb and basically try to bring the most accurate pronunciations. We'll be very mindful about your concern. And
yeah, and it's not a criticism of any particular producer or anchor. It's just kind of, you know, general advice that, you know, we can all work toward achieving.
And
but thanks for your efforts.
Point well taken, and I tried to pronounce the language as close as possible phonetically, since I am aware of a few languages myself, and I want to get away from the Americanization of others' human beings' language. And so we got some more callers. Caller, are you there?
I am.
Great.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Talking to you. Go ahead.
I'm actually calling from an area outside of Portland in the Corvallis area, and I would like to hear more news outside of Portland, and I know several people who have tried to contribute news about the Willamette Valley to your newscast, and it's very difficult to get information to you, that maybe you could set up a news tip hotline or a place that specifically is only about news gathering, not just a general email. So when things come up, people, and then have some tips about what kind of information you would want in that particular report, maybe contact numbers and what the most important thing about it is. If you can't use individuals from the Willamette Valley in your newscast, you know, live, at least to get some information about what's going on in the rest of the world, because we're out here and the transmitters are here. I think there's one in the Columbia Gorge, maybe. And I would love to hear what else is going on in the world that's from the standpoint of the KBOO newsroom. You know, I know you call yourself radical, progressive, I don't know, but it's really interesting, and I love to listen to it, and I encourage you to keep it up, but just include more of the voices in your listening area.
Yes, another point well taken, and I'm quite aware of the vibrancy that's outside the Portland area, and I'm also quite aware of our Portland-centric bias of our newscast, but we're changing that. Believe me, we're working that. Next caller, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I want to thank you guys for putting the time and energy into producing such a really high-quality news service and newscast, both the morning and evening news.
It's a pleasure.
I don't think I could live without it. Well, I could live without it, but certainly not as richly. The other thing is, and this is probably just a real small thing, and this may be my own personal style, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about, you know, some news articles, more often on, you know, like hemp, industrial, the situation in the U.S., Canada, and things like that. And maybe every once in a while a article or two more, because I only hear them occasionally, like very rarely. And maybe something more on the economics, too, in that area. But that's all I'd request. Otherwise, I think you guys have a great show.
That's another valid point. We try to be as ambiguous and diverse as possible. I could understand. I admit myself it's been a while since I heard a particular story about hemp, etc., medical marijuana. We basically follow a programming charter, and we try to incorporate as many unpopular or in terms of like the media landscape stories that don't get a lot of press coverage inside our media, and we'll do the best we can to try to incorporate more of hemp and medical marijuana stuff into our newscast. Thank you very much.
Okay, caller, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that compared to other stations around the country that I hear on the Internet, public radio stations, I think KABU is very adventurous with its news and very all the work that you're talking about that goes into it really shows, and you do an amazing job. What I see as the problem is your music programming. The music programming just doesn't stand up compared to other stations, and the lack of effort and the lack of knowledge in music is really apparent. And I think that it does a disservice to the news because...
Okay, caller, thank you very much. And that's okay. We have that in our minds. So that is the end of that. And now...
Hey, it's me, Lisa Loving. I just wanted to thank everyone that called. We have run out of time for the call-in segment, and maybe sometime when we reconstitute our broadcast, we will actually figure out a way to have a call-in during the evening news, which I think is pretty cool, by the way. Information about Try On Life Community Farm, that interview went so quickly that we had to just move on, but reach Try On Community Farm at tryonfarm.org, tryonfarm.org, and you can call them at 503-245-3847. Eduardo and Noah, back to you with our closing credits.
That's the KABU Evening News for Thursday, January 5th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kabu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast are myself and Lisa Loving. Tonight's audio editor is Michael Newman. Special thanks to reporters Andy Seaton and Joshua Johnson. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Eduardo Delanderos Tierra. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7:30, it's Annie and Melody, who will be hosting Positively Revolting Talk Radio. They'll be discussing a variety of events, including the recent Portland police killing and the case of Jack Abramoff. Then at 9, it's APA Compass. It's KABU's Asian and Pacific Islander Collective. This month, the focus is on APA activism and the civil rights movement. At 10, the topic is the future of Israel and Palestine after Sharon. The host is Per Fagerin. Then at 10:30, on Sounds of Awareness, hear about accessibility in art museums. Then, of course, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered and listener-sponsored community radio station. Mil gracias. Thanks for joining us and our community. Ciao.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 5th of January, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The Hoopa Reservation in Humboldt County, California, finally has power restored after high winds felled trees and downed power lines last weekend. Joe Orozco, station manager of KIDE on the reservation, says power was restored at 4 p.m. Tuesday, but wasn't expected until today. Orozco says originally rising flood levels on the Trinity River were the focus, but the water level only reached 40 feet, about flood monitoring stage, though it was predicted to be much higher. Orozco says once the reservation of about 3,000 dodged the bullet concerning flooding, they were faced with a huge windstorm that knocked out power lines to most of Humboldt County on Saturday morning. He says as of Wednesday, 1,400 residents are still without power.
Because so many trees went down and slip-outs because there was so much rain, there's a lot of slides, so it was hard to get the repair units to some of the sites, and they're still having problems.
Orozco says the power outage prompted the tribal council to meet to discuss an emergency plan for dealing with things like the need for drinking water and batteries.
When the power went out, we had a water shortage because of our public utilities district switched over to a new water treatment plant, and the filtering system clogged on it. So a lot of residents were experiencing very low water, drinking water, household water.
Meanwhile, 14 miles northwest of the Hoopa Reservation is the Yurok tribe, located at the confluence of the Trinity and Klamath Rivers.
The Klamath River crested about 47 feet, which was well above flood stage.
Jeffrey Riggs, public relations manager for the 5,000-member Yurok tribe, says things have improved since initial flooding took place last weekend.
If you'd talk to me Friday of last week, I might have been singing a different song, but at this point, we're cautiously optimistic about the way things are going.
He says the Yurok headquarters is at the mouth of the river, and the reservation runs 47 miles up the Klamath.
Those are some of the areas that we're concerned about right now, a combination of mudslide situations or cuts in the road caused by flowing water. So the some of the roads in those areas are a bit iffy, although most of them are passable at this point, and we're still waiting assessment by Caltrans for that.
Riggs says the focus right now is restoring power and getting potable water and bottled water to those in need. He says there have been no injuries reported as of Wednesday, and the tribe is taking care of immediate needs out of its general assistance fund, but they are working with state and federal agencies and will apply for emergency relief funds as well. In other news, in Connecticut, a tribal faction has seized control of the Scaticoke Nation's reservation. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
On December 31st, Scaticoke Indian tribe members took over the tribe's office and picnic pavilion, forcing out the rival Scaticoke tribal nation. The reservation was once more than 1,000 acres, but has been reduced during hundreds of years of land sales. Members of the faction that took it over say they plan to develop the property along the Housatonic River for houses and unspecified economic development. The two groups claim to represent the tribe that has lived in Kent, Connecticut since the 1700s. They have feuded since the 1970s. Last October, the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs overturned federal recognition granted to the Scaticoke Tribal Nation. Connecticut politicians strongly opposed the recognition, fearing the tribe would try to open a casino. Both factions of the tribe say they are interested in developing a casino. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, the host of Jay's Place on KBOO Radio. I would like to invite you to the Martin Luther King Celebration, Friday, January 13th, And again, on Monday, the 16th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., we'll have street interviews. You can call in and give your opinions live on air about the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King. Listen to great gospel music and hear some of Dr. King's famous speeches, I Have a Dream, On the Mountaintop, and more. So tune in Friday, January the 13th, and Monday, January the 16th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., and help us celebrate Dr. King's life. This is why we say we want to be your community voice and your musical choice.